Well, thanks for everybody coming out this evening. We've got another lesson in our Encountering Jesus series going on tonight. And tonight is the story of the Roman centurion that had the servant that was sick and asked Jesus to help heal him. So we're going to dive right into this. We've got a lot to talk about. We've got a great story to talk about tonight. So first of all, though, before we go into the passage, I'd like you, as this passage is being read to you this evening, to try and picture this scene. Try to draw a mental picture of what this must have looked like, the people that were there, and just kind of get a picture in your head of what this must have looked like. So we're going to start out. Our text is Matthew 8, 5 through 13. Matthew 8, 5 through 13. You would? Okay, thank you. All right, now, did everybody kind of get that mental picture in their head as this was being read? You kind of have that locked in your head, I hope. Just hold it there for a minute. We're going to read another account of this same story from Luke chapter 7, verses 1 through 10. Hang on, I think you're in the wrong section there. Luke 7, 1 through 10.
I'm excited.
You and me both. That's all right. I'll read it. I've got it here. Okay. You got it?
Luke 7, 1-10.
Yeah.
I'll be reading from the NIV. When Jesus finished saying all this in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum. There a centurion servant, whom his master valued highly, was sick and about to die. The centurion heard of Jesus and sent some elders of the Jews to him, asking him to come and heal his servant. When they came to Jesus, they pleaded earnestly with him. This man deserves to have you do this, because he loves our nation and has built our synagogue. So Jesus went to him. He was not far from the house when a centurion sent friends to say to him, Lord, don't trouble yourself, for I do not deserve to have you come under my roof. That is why I did not even consider myself worthy to come to you. But say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority, the soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes, and that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and it doesn't. When Jesus heard this, he was amazed at him, and turning to the crowd following him, he said, I tell you, I have not found such great faith even in Israel. Then the men who had been sent returned to the house and found the servant well.
Okay, thank you. Now, when we read the account in Luke, did the picture that you had painted in your head from the Matthew account, did it change at all? It did for me as well. There's some differences between the two. And we're going to take a quick look at that. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time looking at those differences, but the main difference being that in Matthew, it sounds as if the centurion and Jesus met face to face. And also in Matthew, Jesus gives a little bit of an explanation as to who is going to be saved and who will not be saved. We'll get into that a little bit later, but the that's the main difference. And in Luke, we read that the centurion sent elders from the Jews to speak to Jesus and to make this request of Jesus. Now, the question is, what's the difference here? Which of these accounts is correct? Well, they're both correct. It's just one gives a little more detail than the other account does. Luke gives a little more, I guess, meat on the bone as to the story as to who said what. And one of the things I find interesting is that who he sent. The centurion sent the elders from the local Jewish community to make this request of Jesus. That just seemed odd to me. First of all, a centurion making a request to a Jew, and by some people's reputations, certainly some of the Romans, a troublemaker of a Jew, and he sends elders from the Jewish community to make this request of Jesus. So, I don't want to spend too much time getting into the different accounts, but it's a good illustration of why it's important whenever we study the Bible to look at the different accounts and try to gather all the information we can. Certainly, these are both interesting passages, and some one passage gives information, the other doesn't. But it's an interesting study in how the same story told from different perspectives can be a little bit different, but when you put them together, they do make sense. Okay, so we got that out of the way. Let's move on to the story itself. Who are the characters involved in the story? Well, obviously we've got Jesus himself. He was there. The centurion was a character, a big character in this story. The elders that the centurion sent to speak to Jesus. The servant. Didn't know much about him, but he was in the story. And the people that were traveling with Jesus were there as well. So let's go through and look at each one of these. Jesus, I think we all know who he was and most of his story, but it's interesting to look at where he was at what point in his ministry this occurred, and who was with him at the time. Where he was at was Capernaum. This was close to the Sea of Galilee. This is where Jesus did a lot of his ministry. So he was well familiar with the area, and the people in that area had certainly heard of him. When this happened was early to midpoint in Jesus' ministry. Like I said, a lot of people in the area had heard of Jesus at this point, maybe had witnessed some of his miracles. Certainly there was a lot of buzz going around about Jesus at this point. I think everybody in the area had at least heard of Jesus, even if they didn't know who he was or exactly why he was there or what he was doing, but they had heard the name. And of course, Jesus was not alone when this happened. He had a crowd that followed him everywhere he went. He had the apostles. He had people that were wanting to learn more from him. There were people that were just curious coming out to see this guy because they had heard the name. There probably were people traveling in that crowd that were looking for some reason to criticize Jesus and do him harm, trying to discredit him. But anyway, there was a crowd with him at the time. All right, the centurion. Now here's the key guy in the whole story. First of all, let's talk about what a centurion is. A centurion was a Roman soldier, but he wasn't a common Roman soldier. A Roman soldier was roughly equivalent to what a private in our army would be today. He's kind of a low-ranking soldier in the army. A centurion would be roughly equivalent to, say, a master sergeant or a lieutenant or a captain, somewhere a junior officer in the army. And they were called centurions because they were in command of 100 men. So you get the century name in the centurion. So they had 100 men under them. And they were responsible for these men. They were responsible for training them, teaching them how to fight, disciplining them. There's lots of stories in secular history about how the centurions would take a vine stick and beat these soldiers when it became necessary to discipline them. I mean, they weren't messing around with these guys. Centurions themselves were not, they were not the kind of leaders who would sit up on the hillside and watch the battle unfold down in the valley. These were fighting men. They led from the front. They were there, right there with the soldiers, and they had a very high casualty rate as a result of that. They were battle tested. You didn't get to be a centurion just by showing up and say, "I want to be a centurion." These guys, they had to have some qualifications in addition to being good soldiers and brave and knowing how to fight. And I'll go through some of these, some of the qualities that you had to be a centurion. First of all, they had to be literate. Of course, you had to be able to read and write orders. If you were given written orders, you had to be able to read them. You got to have some connections, letters of recommendation. You couldn't just be some guy off the street that no one had ever heard of. Somebody had to recommend you for the job. Had to be at least 30 years of age. And keep in mind, back then, the average lifespan was, you know, maybe in the 40s. So weren't going to get to be a centurion by, you know, coming straight out of school. You had to put in some time. And you had to have served in the military a few years. Centurions were also chosen for their size and their strength and their ability to fight, being able to throw missiles and spears and things like that, be able to use a sword and a shield. Like I said, these guys were fighting guys. They weren't somebody to trifle with. Also had to be vigilant, temperate, which a little bit shocking. I mean, you would think you would want somebody that was just as bloodthirsty as you could get, but you also had to have somebody that would use their head and think and not make rash decisions in battle. And you had to be able to take orders from your superiors. Being a centurion didn't mean that you were in charge of the whole army. You had superiors above you that gave you orders, and you were expected to follow those. And like I said, they had to be in charge of their 100 men. They had to oversee their training, make sure that they were physically fit, kept their weapons polished, their armor. They had to look presentable, had to keep them in line, essentially, is what it came down to. So that was a typical centurion, but I think for a lot of reasons that we can look at here, this was not a typical centurion we were talking about. I mean, I'm sure he had all these attributes, but this one also had some really interesting things about him that are worth pointing out. First of all, he was well respected by the Jewish elders. Back in, let's see, Luke's account, verse 5. "For he loves our nation and has built us a synagogue." How many Roman centurions do you imagine went around building synagogues? I can't even imagine. It had to be maybe the only one in history. And he loves our nation, not just tolerates our nation or gets along with it, but he loves our nation. Now keep in mind, when you're a Roman soldier and you're stationed essentially overseas in a foreign land, Israel, you're probably not wanting to be there. You would rather be home with your family and friends, or at least closer to home. Most of these soldiers were not happy to be stationed in Israel. And so there was a natural, I guess, contempt for the native people of the area. And if you were a Roman citizen, you kind of looked down your nose at the rest of the world and said, well, you know, Rome is the center of civilization and everybody else is, you know, kind of second class to that, or maybe third class. So for this particular soldier to not only be there, but to love the nation that is there, and to build them a synagogue, I mean, that's very unusual. That says something about this man. What else do they say about him? We know this centurion greatly valued his servant. We don't know why. Maybe the servant had been with him for a while, or you know, had done something extraordinary in the past, but for whatever reason, he thought a lot of this servant. And we'll take a look at some of the extraordinary things that he did for this servant. This centurion was also apparently religious guy. You know, helping out in the community might have been a smart political move on his part, just to, you know, get along with the indigenous people there. But to actually build him a synagogue, again, that's going a step or two beyond what is normal. And keep in mind that the Roman army was not Jewish. So for this guy to build him a synagogue, somebody up the line, one of his superiors, had to be asking, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? You know, what's your motive here? And I'm sure he had to answer some questions about that. And that could have even put his career or possibly even his life in jeopardy. I mean, they may have been questioning his loyalty to Rome. You know, why are you going to these lengths to fit into the local community? The thing that really stands out about this centurion, though, is he was a believer in Jesus. He would not have sent those men to ask Jesus to heal his servant if he didn't think that Jesus had the ability to do it. So, for some reason, we don't know why, for some reason he believed that Jesus had the power to do this. One other thing that stands out in relation to that is he called him Lord. Let's see, Luke 7, verse 6. He sent friends to him saying, Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy that you should enter under my roof. Why would he call Jesus Lord unless he obviously thought that Jesus was deserving of that level of respect? We've got a passage that relates to that. That'd be Matthew 7, verses 28 and 29.
And it came to pass when Jesus had ended these sayings, the people were astonished at his doctrine, for he taught them as one having authority and not as a scribe.
Yeah, and the key to that, I think, right there is that Jesus spoke with authority. And while we can talk about Jesus' authority, for some reason, this centurion had heard Jesus or heard of him and recognized that authority. Now, keep in mind, as a centurion, he's got superiors above him giving him orders all the time, so he knew how to respect authority. And when he calls Jesus Lord, He's showing that respect. He's recognizing that Jesus is greater than him. And there again, he's taking a big risk. I mean, not just career-wise, but possibly his life. If somebody up the line above him were to find out that he's calling this Jewish rabbi or teacher or whatever the Romans would have called him, if he's calling him Lord, again, that's going to raise questions. They're going to want to know, what are you doing? This is just a commoner here in this land. Maybe he's a prophet. Maybe he's, whatever, but why are you calling him Lord? So I think it's interesting that the centurion seemed to be willing to take some chances with his career and his life, maybe his freedom, by not only helping out the local Jews build a synagogue, but when Jesus comes to town, he is willing to just essentially fall down at Jesus' feet and say, Lord, I need help. I recognize that you are a great person and I need you to help me with this problem. Okay, so we know who the centurion is at this point. We never did know his name, and I guess it's not important, or we would have been told. But who else was there? Well, the elders of the Jews, the local Jews. We don't know much about them. We don't know their name. But again, there's some really unusual things about them. They apparently had a great deal of respect for the centurion. Luke 7, verse 4. And when they came to Jesus, they begged him earnestly, saying that the one for whom he should do this was deserving, for he loves our nation and has built us a synagogue. These guys weren't just doing a favor for the centurion. They came to Jesus and begged him to help them. And that says something about their level of respect for the centurion. They weren't just casual friends. I mean, they were doing everything they could to help this guy. Okay, on to the servant. We don't know much about him. We don't know his name. All we know really is that he was gravely ill. And the centurion must have thought a lot about him because he risked quite a bit to try and save him. He called in a pretty big favor from the Jewish elders. And of course, they were happy to help. So, again, we don't know what this servant has done in the past to garner this much respect and what he has done in the past that he is so well loved by the centurion, but apparently he was a good guy. And then finally, the crowd was there, the crowd that followed Jesus. And most notably, I think the apostles. The apostles were traveling with Jesus, of course. And again, try to picture this. They're walking along the road, coming into Capernaum. Here come these Jewish elders, and they stop Jesus and they ask him first of all, they recognize, why they're there. They say, we're here on behalf of a Roman centurion, and we're asking that you come and heal this centurion's servant. How many times do you imagine that the apostles had Jewish elders come to them and ask for a favor? Again, I don't know of any other examples in the Bible about it. I can't imagine there was a lot of them. But then, who are they asking the favor for? They're asking for a Roman soldier, a Roman centurion. Jewish elders asking Jesus for a favor on behalf of a Roman. The apostles had to be standing there with their mouths hanging open. They had to be stunned. And it's really interesting that there's no word recorded. Not one word did they utter in this whole account. And you just imagine them standing there wondering what's going to happen next because they can't believe what they're seeing. So anyway, we've got a good rundown of everybody that was there and who they were. So what did Jesus do? Well, when Jesus heard the request, he was stunned. He marveled at the faith of the centurion. And that's recorded in Matthew 8, 10. When Jesus heard it, he marveled and said to those who followed, "Assuredly, I say to you, I have not found such great faith, not even in Israel." And again, in Luke, a very, very similar passage. Luke 7 and verse 9. When Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him and turned around and said to the crowd that followed him, "I say to you, I have not found such great faith, not even in Israel." Why do you think Jesus was so stunned by this? What was it that just caught Jesus off guard? Why did he marvel at this? Any thoughts? That's right. Yeah, a Roman, a typical Roman was a pagan. And for a pagan to come to Jesus and say, "You know, I have faith in you. I know you can do this. Please help me with this problem." It just had to be something very unusual for Jesus to see. I mean, I'm sure he was running up against people every day that didn't have faith, both in and out of the nation of Israel. But to have a pagan walk up to you and say, "Hey, I know you have the power to do this. Please help." It had to be something very unusual. And I think it's one of the reasons it's in the Bible is that this teaches the lesson, or one of the lessons, about how the nation of Israel is not guaranteed to be saved. Jesus touches on this in Matthew, starting in verse 11. "And I say to you that many will come from east and west and sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the sons of the kingdom will be cast out into outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." Jesus touches on something here that gets described later in more detail, but essentially what he's saying is, hey, just because you're a member of the nation of Israel doesn't mean you've got it made. And also, it says that others, east and west, will sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So that means that you don't have to be a Jew to be saved. And like I said, it gets described later on, but that's the first time we've heard Jesus allude to that. Is there any questions so far? I've been rambling along here pretty good. Okay. All right, so we come to the real pivotal question of the whole lesson, encountering Jesus. How was this Roman centurion's life changed by his meeting Jesus? Anybody got any thoughts on that? Well, I'll tell you what I'm thinking about it. When I read this, I kind of scratched my head a little bit. And I thought, you know, this account, well, both accounts, both Matthew and Luke, I don't really see a change in the centurion. I think that the centurion already was a believer. It seems to me that it was pretty obvious he was a believer. So I think his mind was already made up. And I don't really see a change in his thinking as a result of this encounter. What is not described is how he came to that point. He must have had a previous encounter with Jesus somewhere along the way. He must have seen or heard Jesus speak, maybe saw some miracles performed. Something in the past convinced this centurion that Jesus was not an ordinary man. Oh, yes.
I was just going to say everybody heard him. And so it's not surprising at all that he would know about it because everybody, I mean, it's documented both, you know, in the scriptures, when you look at all the crowds that came, even when Jesus tried to run and get away from people, they figured out where he was. Everybody knew. So it really doesn't surprise me that he had heard the stories and talked to people about it.
Right. And as I said, there was a lot of buzz going around about Jesus at the time. Obviously, some people believed what they heard, others didn't. This man believed. We don't know why. We don't know what he had seen. We don't know what he had heard. But it's something in the past, he had been exposed to Jesus. And that's when the change occurred. That's when he became a believer in Jesus. This particular encounter, I don't think really changed his mind about that. I think he was just showing his faith in what he already knew. Now, were there other people changed by this encounter? I think there is. Obviously, the servant was healed. That was a big positive change for him. I'm sure he was glad to have that happen. The elders of the Jews, we don't have anything recorded. But that may have had an impact on them as well, to see what happened to the servant because of their request. That may have got them thinking about, well, maybe this Jesus that they've heard of, maybe there's something to this guy. Maybe he's just, you know, he's not a magician. He's who he says he is. And then finally, the apostles. Were the apostles changed by this encounter? And I think the answer there has got to be yes. Two of them thought it was important enough to write it down, or we wouldn't know about it. So it made an impact on them as well. So, yeah, I believe there was a good reason for this to be written down and for us to have this available to us, this lesson. I guess the question is, how has Jesus, your encounter with Jesus, how has that changed your life? We've all had different experiences. But at some point, something has happened in your life that has made you want to come here tonight and learn more about Jesus. So there is something there for us to take home as well, is think about what it is that has changed your life and what has that change brought? And is it everything you wanted it to be? If not, then maybe you need to dig a little deeper. Maybe you need to give that some thought. Okay, so the lights have flickered, so that means we're either in a thunderstorm or it's time for me to shut up. So, anybody got any questions? Yeah, yeah. I think he
was truly humble.
He not only knew about Jesus, he believed in Jesus. And again, we don't know what it was in the past that caused him to think that. Maybe he heard the Sermon on the Mount. Maybe he saw some miracles performed. Maybe he saw people being healed. I don't know. But something certainly did change him in the past. And We're glad. Go ahead.
Verse 13 there in Matthew, Jesus said to him, the very last sentence there, "Go, it will be done just as you believed it would."
Right. Yeah, this wasn't, I don't think this was a Hail Mary on behalf of the centurion, just, you know, trying everything he could to heal the servant. I think he honestly believed it would be done if he could get the request to Jesus, which he did. Yeah. Right. And it happened. So. Okay. Thank you.